This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And I'm sure that many of you are going to find this a very compelling subject because irritable bowel syndrome and associated GI disorders, highly prevalent. If you do not suffer from it personally, you certainly have a loved one or friend or associate who's afflicted with this condition. We're going to talk to one of the foremost experts on this area. He's been a previous guest in this program. I invited him back because he really offers a very comprehensive view on IBS. He's Dr. Benjamin Brown. He's an Australian naturopathic physician who now lives in the UK, and he's contributing editor to Integrative Healthcare and Applied Nutrition, also author of a great book, The Digestive Health Solution. And he writes and blogs frequently about subjects related to not just digestive health, but also integrative medicine in general. He's a great resource. And so without further ado, here's Dr. Benjamin Brown. Welcome back. It's nice having you back on Intelligent Medicine.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Thank you so much. It's a privilege to be able to talk to you.
Okay. And where am I speaking to you from? Where are you now?
I'm in London, England.
Okay. So through the miracle of modern communications, I hope it's not too late for you over there. You know, it's not past your bedtime. We made it a little bit earlier stateside so that you wouldn't be falling into your teacups.
I appreciate it.
In the past, you've written a very interesting article with a great tagline, 9 Common Myths About Digestive Problems. So maybe we can tee off on this subject by dispelling some of the myths about IBS.
Yeah, absolutely. You may need to lead me through some of those myths, but I think one of the key ones that really comes up for a lot of people is this idea that it's all in people's heads. And I mean, this has plagued irritable bowel syndrome since its inception as an idea or syndrome. And one of the issues is in the name itself, you know, irritable. It sounds like it's, you know, a psychological problem. But it's not at all. It's physiological. And that's where the term originates from. In fact, it's quite clear and a fairly reproducible phenomena in people with this cluster of symptoms we call irritable bowel syndrome is an irritation of the gastrointestinal tract itself. And it is easy to cause pain and discomfort with what is otherwise fairly normal phenomena for other people, like eating and swallowing and digesting food, will become painful and cause discomfort and other serious symptoms in people with this thing called IBS. So I think that's one of the probably most important myths that really needs to be dispelled for people.
And in one of your papers, you say that IBS is not one, kind of a wastebasket term. Okay, you don't have ulcerative colitis, you don't have bleeding, you don't have inflammation that's detectable. So then you end up being given this wastebasket diagnosis of IBS. Yes, you're in distress. We acknowledge it. We'll give it a name. It's not one, but more than a dozen different conditions, which are, you know, each amenable to a strategy. And there's no single approach that helps each and every patient.
Right. Absolutely. And I think the sad thing is that both you and I know this, but the problem is that, you know, this is not the way people are looking at irritable bowel syndrome. is having underlying manageable causes. The tragic thing, and people who've experienced IBS and not got any help from their physician or, you know this, is that they're given this label, they're given maybe symptomatic treatment at best, which isn't very effective and often can make things worse in other ways, and they just don't get better.
In fact, in one of your papers, you cite that the success rate of current available strategies, and we'll talk about some of the standard treatments and their inadequacies, it's only about a quarter, 25% of people report improvements, and that leaves a lot of people high and dry.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's really underappreciated too is the severity of IBS for some people. It can be really crippling, you know, really impact their ability to hold down relationships, mm-hmm. jobs, affect their quality of life. It can be horrible. And, you know, if you're given options that just don't work very well and certainly don't resolve the problem, you are high and dry, as you put it.
And it literally can create agoraphobia, people who are afraid to go out of the house. You know, that they sometimes spend the morning, embracing the toilet bowl, so to speak, preparing themselves, evacuating, and spending an inordinate time getting ready to sally forth into the world. And then they have to worry about, you know, where's the nearest bathroom, literally.
Right.
And, you know, they can't go to a sporting event. They can't go to a movie, a theater, romantic possibilities are precluded. All kinds of devastating consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's a really great way to put it, is it is almost developing a kind of agoraphobia where people have difficulty just going out into the world. It's true.
So what are some of the conventional treatments, and what are, you know, what's the success rate, the pluses and minuses of current approaches for IBS?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, typically the treatments that are given to people with IBS are based on a pretty simplistic classification criteria. So normally when people, we could go into more depth on diagnosis, but normally people are labeled with IBS and then they sort of fall into a few categories depending on their bowel movements, whether they're suffering more from constipation, more diarrhea, or more mixed symptoms, or maybe they have a more troubling symptom like pain. And based on that observation clinically, they're just given symptomatic treatments. So things like antispasmodics, antidepressants may be sometimes used for pain relief, antidiarrheals, or fiber if they're constipated.
Yeah, that's often the prescription. It's like, take some Metamucil, okay?
Yeah.
And, you know, call me in the morning, or, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And it just doesn't work well for most people. It's a fact.
It can backfire. You know, the adding fiber to the diets or artificial fiber to people who already have a distension and bloating can make things worse.
Absolutely, and this is a really well established fact that I think again is underappreciated, is that fiber will aggravate symptoms for some people. Why are we doing this and not being more aware of this and personalizing therapy? You know, some people may benefit, but other people are made worse.
So, there's a new kid on the block in terms of therapeutic options for IBS, and because it involves prescribing a drug, doctors just love to reach for their prescription pad. The notion of SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, has become popular because it yields a prescription for a medication called Xifaxan or Rifaximin. I don't know what it's called across the pond, but here it's the brand name is Xifaxan. An expensive drug, a drug that is sometimes helpful for patients. Is that an overly simplistic approach to SIBO?
I feel like it is. And, you know, I know you've worked with SIBO for many years and been, you know, very aware of the developments of therapeutic approaches to this, but there are a few key limitations with this idea that you do a SIBO test and you prescribe an antibiotic. And the first one is that the, you know, it's a very limited view of IBS is the first thing, is that that is not the only cause or reason why people might have symptoms. So it's not, unfortunately, as easy as, oh, look, we found an underlying problem that'll help most people. And
find a bug, use a drug. We sometimes use that meme.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's not, unfortunately, it's not that simple. Wouldn't it be great if it was? And the problem is the test itself has a degree of inaccuracy, which then throws into question the, you know, what we're seeing with the medication. But the medication itself also doesn't work that well for a lot of people and could potentially have adverse effects in the long term as well. So it does have really important limitations. As you point out, it can work well for some patients, but as a whole, it doesn't appear to be a really effective intervention for the majority of people, and it certainly isn't doesn't appear to be a cure.
When it comes to diet, I think doctors have a very limited understanding of the proper strategy for irritable bowel syndrome. Commonly, they'll say, well, you know, make sure you have a high-fiber diet. You know, make sure you eat lots of fruits and vegetables to support your digestion. And for some people, that works. You know, if they're eating, a very poor quality, ultra-processed food diet and they're constipated, adding plenty of natural fiber is beneficial and can restore natural peristalsis and relieve symptoms. But in many cases, that's an inadequate strategy.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I mean, one of the, you know, it's almost an immutable truth around diet and nutrition is that everyone's different and they respond differently to different foods. And the case of fiber in IBS is just a classic example of that, is that it, you rightly point out, it will help some people, but other people will feel a lot worse. And it's unfortunately a bit unclear why that's occurring. It may be something to do with differences in bugs in the gut or the sensitivity of the bowel to, you know, to distension and fiber and, you know, that fermentation that occurs. But the reality is that some people just don't respond and they can feel a lot worse on fiber. So we need to be very conscious of that. And, you know, if you are told to try fiber, it really should be in a graded sort of investigative or titrated type approach to see if you tolerate it.
Mm-hmm. And then there's actually what is sort of the opposite of that approach, which is a lower residue diet or a low FODMAP diet. Can you talk about that and its potential in addressing IBS symptoms? And for some patients, that's a real slam dunk.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the low FODMAP diet is a really interesting therapeutic intervention developed by a group of researchers at Monash University several years ago. And it's really moved into prime time now. You know, a lot of people are aware of it, talking about it, utilizing it. And fundamentally, it works by restricting fermentable carbohydrates in the diet. And when I say fermentable, it means your gut bacteria can digest and metabolize these, produce gas, and that could be a problem if you've got a really sensitive bowel. The important thing is, and I think as a caveat, is that that's also quite healthy. You know, if you think about it, this fermentation of fiber is really critical. And that's important when we talk about the FODMAP diet, because there are sort of limitations in some ways to this approach, in that it should really be viewed as a symptomatic approach and more short term. So it has, we're looking at it really as a therapeutic symptomatic intervention and not something you necessarily do for life, but you do short term to get those symptoms under control.
Yeah, that's what I generally tell patients, is that this is not a lifetime prescription. It's sort of an experiment to see if you can alleviate your symptoms, maybe rebalance your intestinal flora, and then we can reintroduce more foods. Because the very guy who developed this, Professor Gibson down there in Australia, refers to something called Gibson's conundrum, which is this idea that, you know, okay, you restrict the fermentation, but you actually need the fermentation of certain fibers to produce beneficial short-chain fatty acids, which actually heal the gut and which are essential for gut health. So, you know, it's kind of, okay, we can alleviate symptoms, but maybe it's to the detriment long-term of patients, as you pointed out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's well put. And I think one of the curious things about the low FODMAP diet too is I'm starting to feel like it's many roads can lead to Rome, and you know, there are other ways to get symptomatic improvement in people that may be easier sometimes or more effective in certain patients. So you know, I think we need to step back and look at the FODMAP diet, as you rightly put, as just an experiment to see if we can alleviate symptoms in the short term.
A curious choice of phraseology, because it's actually the Rome classifications that are characterizing chronic irritable bowel syndrome.
Yeah, that's
right.
True.
That's what they use. They use a certain set of criteria to say, you know, so that's an interesting choice of words. There are other dietary strategies that are sometimes employed. Some people go on a gluten-free diet, and yet that's been critiqued because they say, well, you know, that's kind of a fad. That's what, you know, Hollywood stars are and celebrities are using and influencers are talking about on, Instagram and Twitter. But it's a disservice to tell people not to have wheat if they are not suffering from actual celiac disease. So do you think there's something short of, you know, full-blown celiac disease that merits a trial of a gluten-free diet?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's really emerged in the literature is this curious reactivity to gluten we call non-celiac gluten sensitivity. And it is somewhat controversial, but it is clearly something of a clinical reality. And, you know, I think I do see this criticism of gluten-free diets too. And certainly there are shortfalls of gluten-free diets. If you don't need to be doing it, it could be a problem. And it's also spawned a junk food industry. So
right. You have to the gluten-free Oreos, you know, the gluten-free muffins, and, you know, they've got twice as many calories and blah, 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 you know.
Right. Yeah. So it certainly does have problems. But I think if celebrities and influencers are talking about it, it's probably representative of how big the problem is.
Right.
And certainly we don't know what the real issue is, because there's no really robust biomarker for this kind of gluten sensitivity at the moment. So it's a little bit vague, but it does seem to have a relatively high prevalence, could be 5 to 10% of the population, which is huge. And certainly in people with symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome, well, this is one of the criteria that have been proposed for diagnosing non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So it is really suggested that if you're exhibiting with these symptoms, you should at least be trying a gluten-free diet for a period of time to see if your symptoms alleviate, because wouldn't that be wonderful and solve you a whole lot of other problems?
Indeed, it's a quick fix for a lot of people, yeah. I think one of the myths that you touch upon, or certainly one of the myths that's prevalent about irritable bowel syndrome, and even the medical profession, is that we tend to be binary about digestive disorders. We say, okay, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, those are inflammatory disorders. We can go in there with a sigmoidoscope or a colonoscope and we can see how red and irritated the tissue is. But if that's not present, then, you know, all your digestive symptoms are IBS and there's no inflammation. But maybe there's some, you know, subtypes of IBS where there is inflammation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, as our investigative tools are getting better, both clinically and scientifically, what has become apparent is that IBS does have an inflammatory component or subtype, as you beautifully put it, is there may be some people in which this is really a factor. And this is a really fascinating area that's being explored currently in this field. And it does appear that some or a subset of people who fall into this criteria of IBS do have elevated levels of inflammation that could be measured clinically even by your physician with more sensitive biomarkers. And if you do have that, it's likely, we don't know for sure yet because the science hasn't caught up with this yet, but it's likely that if you target that inflammatory process that's occurring and driving these IBS-like symptoms, you could really bring about significant relief for people. So I think this is a very exciting area that could help a subset of people with IBS.
So one paradigm that has been successful in treating a lot of patients with more serious conditions, with Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, is something called the specific carbohydrate diet. And that's a diet which is designed to break the vicious cycle of bacterial proliferation. The bacteria that crosstalk to the immune system in the gut, and it's, you know, how do you change that? Well, you can take tons of antibiotics from here to kingdom come, but how important is diet at breaking the vicious cycle of bad bacteria or dysbiosis in the gut that might ultimately be a trigger for inflammation and IBS?
It's absolutely crucial. And the sad thing is it's just overlooked, you know, because as you put it earlier, we're looking for drugs for bugs, and it's not just drugs, but natural products as well. By far, the biggest impact on the microbiome factor that's impacting our microbiome on a daily basis is the food that we're eating. And next to that, things like antibiotics and probiotics and, you know, they look a bit insignificant, but sadly, it's a bit unexplored. The specific carbohydrate diet is an exception in the sense that there is considerable research that's happening behind that. We know that it influences the microbiome, which appears to be part of its mechanism of action. So it's really emerging as an important therapeutic intervention and has been studied in IBS. In fact, like it does in irritable bowel disease, it does seem to alleviate symptoms of IBS as well.
And you mentioned probiotics. And in IBS, probiotics can be a two-edged sword. I mean, there are products that are mainstream commercial products. Danone yogurts contain something called Align, which is a proprietary probiotic that's supposed to help IBS. It's a little hit or miss. But what's the deal on probiotics? Good, bad, indifferent?
Yeah, I think they're a little bit oversold. I mean, they are an effective therapy and they do work for some people. But the clinical realities, like when you we've got a lot of data now we can look at. And when you look at the data on probiotics, they tend to work for, reasonably well for about 1 in 7 people. And then they result in about a roughly 50% reduction in symptoms. So they are hit and miss and they're not solving the problem, that's for sure. They're more alleviating some of the symptoms. So very useful clinically, but as you rightly put it, they're hit and miss. And there are positives and negatives to them, but I think, one of the challenges we face with probiotics moving forward is how to identify people who are really going to benefit. But at the moment, we're just not there yet.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of stool tests, stool analyses, and it's like, okay, you have this bug or that bug, and you're missing this or that, but we still don't have kind of a predictive model for who will benefit from which probiotic.
Right.
It's not so simple as, oh, you're missing lactobacillus, so we'll give you lactobacillus and we'll fix everything up. It doesn't work so neatly yet.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. It's sort of the story that's, been sold for many years around probiotics is that, good bugs, bad bugs, take a yogurt and it'll all fix and you'll be good. But in clinical reality, it just, unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. So I think, with time, we'll be able to be more sophisticated with probiotics. And in the meantime, they can be useful to try, for sure. And some people respond really well, but there's certainly a lot more to the overall picture of IBS than just taking a probiotic and hoping it'll go away.
Indeed. All right. We're going to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts. And in part two, I want to focus on solutions. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the most effective strategies for IBS and also talk about the implications of IBS with regard to other related conditions. Fibromyalgia. You recently wrote an article about fibromyalgia. And we'll talk about the link between fibromyalgia and IBS and does diet matter? Can it help sufferers of that challenging condition? Our guest is Dr. Benjamin Brown. He's a naturopathic physician, currently situated in London, England, author of The Digestive Health Solution. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.